Good morning, welcome. I wonder, just sort of thinking about this a little bit, what's a preacher to do? My wife and I have a friend. She gave us a writing some years ago that was, I think, out of her heart, and I enjoyed reading it. But before she gave it to us, she said, "Now, please just keep that to yourself. I don't want to be known by what I write." And I was thinking about that recently. I was reminded twice that sometimes a preacher becomes somewhat known by what he preaches or how he preaches. I'm not sure how to say that exactly. And I don't know, sometimes that probably, at least when it's me, has some negatives involved because maybe I come across too strong, or when I mean to ask a question, I make a statement. And so I guess I'm not sure if I exactly have what a preacher's supposed to do with that. I'll just ask you to bear with me, especially in a message this type this morning. But I want to ask, put a couple questions on board to think about first. Let's just say how, when, where. Does a wise man find, and then I'll give you a list of what he's looking for. Also, how and where. Where does a foolish man find these same things? So I might be running a little low. The first one is meaning. And here I mean to be speaking of the meaning in or of life. Second one is security. Third is pleasure. And the fourth is peace. So interestingly enough, as trying to be correct people, probably most of us don't, if I'd say, "Are you wise?" you'd probably say, "Ah, well, where's he going to take that?" So, nah, not overly. I would say, "Are you foolish?" Well, I don't know, you'd hope not. So maybe you don't think those are good options. And I understand that hesitancy. And the reason I do it, I guess, that way is, as we look at Scripture, it often different times of contrast, right? We talk about the wise and the foolish virgin. And I understand that our life, or at least my life, is very much a journey. And so sometimes I'm very foolish when I meant to be wise. And sometimes maybe I, by the help of God, have a bit of wisdom. Doesn't mean that I feel very wise. So in looking at that, I'd like to read. Got quite a bit of reading to do and then a story to tell you. I invite you to turn to these references. At the same time, if you can listen better without turning, I'll try to read clearly for you. The first one is Psalm 33. Psalm 33, verse 13. "The Lord looketh from heaven. He beholdeth all the sons of men. From the place of his habitation he looketh upon all the inhabitants of the earth." Well, he says the same thing over and over, doesn't it? The Lord looketh from heaven, so wherever God is, and I believe he's right here, but also the place where he dwells, like we can refer to heaven, his seat, he looketh, and he beholdeth all the sons of men, that means all of us, from the place of his habitation, his home, his house, where his headquarters are, he looketh upon all the inhabitants of the earth, again, all of us. Verse 15, he fashioned their hearts alike. Makes me think of the other verse that says, "There's no temptation taking you, but such as is common to man." He fashioned all their hearts alike. We're all looking for some things in life. We all desire things. We have all temptations, battles. Yes, they vary somewhat, yet sometimes they're surprisingly similar. Going on, he considereth all their works. Now, the next verse will be in 1 Corinthians 1. 1 Corinthians 1, beginning at verse 17. I'm breaking in a little bit here. I want the last part. That's a thing of Paul saying how he didn't baptize people because they had this conflict saying, I was baptized by so and so. Verse 17, Paul says, for Christ sent me not to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not with wisdom of words, lest the cross of Christ should be made of none effect. Now think about this. Paul, probably the most educated of the apostles, we could say, was sent to preach, but not with wisdom of words, lest the cross of Christ should be made of none effect. Sort of scary, especially if you need to preach. For the preaching of the cross is to them which perish foolishness, but unto us which are saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise. I will bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this world or the lawyer? Hath not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? For after that, in the wisdom of God, the world by wisdom knew not God. It pleased God by the foolishness of preaching to save them that believe. So if I go back to the beginning of verse 21, it's a little convoluted. He says, for after that, in the wisdom of God, the world by wisdom knew not God. You know, today, any wisdom, and I'm talking in a natural sense, any smarts that any smart man has come from God, right? God gave him the brain, the body, the ability to think. So any smarts he has in that way came from God. But so many smart people today are using their smarts and thinking that they're smarter than what God was. And that's what he's saying. Let's read it again. For after that, in the wisdom of God, the world by wisdom knew not God, because they thought they were so smart. Remember Jason's message last Sunday about the man that got too big to be used? It pleased God by the foolishness of preaching to save them that believe. For the Jews require a sign. They want to see something. They want to have evidence in front of their face. The Greeks seek after wisdom. They want to be convinced. But he says, but we as Christians, we preach Christ crucified, unto the Jews a stumbling block, unto the Greeks foolishness. But unto them which are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. Now there's a quote in there, especially verse 19, is quoted from somewhere. For it is written, and then he says, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and will bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent. Does anybody want to tell me where that's taken from? Without looking at your center reference, that helps. But does anybody know without that? It was Isaiah speaking to Israel about where they were. So if we go to Isaiah chapter 29, verse 13 and 14, I'll just read it. Isaiah 29, 13. Wherefore the Lord said, for as much as this people draw near me with their mouth, and with their lips they do honor me, but they have removed their heart far from me, and their fear toward me is taught by the precept of men. Verse 14. Therefore, behold, I will proceed to do a marvelous work among this people, even a marvelous work and a wonder, for the wisdom of their wise men shall perish, and the understanding of their prudent men shall be hid. So if somebody asks you this morning, are you wise? You do well to be hesitant to answer, don't you? Are you wise? Because there's two ways to be wise. Or shall I say there's two ways to be foolish. I don't know which one I should use. I don't know that one's really better. I just titled this message, The Two Ways to be Foolish. The Two Ways to be Foolish. And I've been rolling this around and it sort of didn't feel like I had as much time to get ready as I wished. So we'll see how this works out. But there was a statement made to me recently, someone quoting from someone else, and I unfortunately don't know who it was quoted from. But as I recall the thought or the idea, it was, as adults, we spend our life trying to recreate the happiness we had as a child. And of course, that's taken for granted you had a pretty decent childhood. Now, those that would have, let's say, had an abusive or a very sad childhood, they, in their twist on this, try to find the happiness they feel they were robbed of. And I'm not going to say whether this is or is not so. It's just an interesting thought that I've been thinking about in relation somewhat to these things. And also, the next thing I'd like to say, one of the biggest mistakes I can make is to squander the present in desiring the future or in longing for the past. And for those of you that were here, I think 2 weeks ago when I preached a message, you'll see how this is somewhat building on that. But one of the biggest mistakes we can make is to squander the present in desiring the future or in longing for the past. Okay, now for the story. I think I was going to double check myself. How many of you have ever heard of the book, The Good Earth? I think I was pretty safe in thinking probably hardly anybody did. So it looks like I'm right there. Okay, that's fine. I don't mean to tell you the whole book. It would take a couple sessions if I was to. But we'll give you a crash on it. It's sort of an interesting story, sort of sad story. This man's name, the best I can say it, is Huang Lung. Now, Huang Lung grew, best I could tell by just the book never really says, but was placed in the late 1800s, so maybe between the after the American Civil War, before the 1900s roughly. So he was an uneducated Chinese farmer. So Huang Lung, interesting, part of the thing that holds my interest in this book is their different culture, very different, what shall we say, goals, ideals, very interesting in that way. So this book begins on Huang Lung's wedding day. And then it does go back a little bit and talk about how they got there. But Huang Lung was a young farmer, unmarried. And in his culture, when he felt the urges, the desire to be married, rather than trying to figure this out on himself, he went and said, "Dad, I need a wife." And so Dad took this serious. And so Dad looked around. He says, "Well, I can't afford the bride's price. So we're going to have to figure something else out." So not far, a couple little ways from them, was a city. And in this city was this great, they called it the Great House of Huang, is another name. But anyway, this great house, wealthy. And these wealthy people had slaves. And so they got the resource for a young man whose dad was too poor to pay the bride's price was to go find a slave to get married to. And the reason the rich people did that, as I understand it, was it... in their superstitious religion, it gave them some benefit in the next life to have had a part in creating another home where possibility of more life. So they were happy to marry off their slaves. So Dad goes and finagles and deals, and anyways, he finally basically buys this girl to be this fellow's wife. And so he comes home and says, "I got one." And Huang Lung, I think he must have been pretty easygoing compared to most of us, right? I don't know. Like, well, I sure hope I had a good relationship with Dad that day, but... One thing he was really strong about is he did not want a pockmarked wife. He thought he could get along with about anything, but pockmarked, no, that was too sad. "Dad, is she pockmarked?" And he's like, "No." I said, "No, she's actually pretty good." And anyway, they had their whole thing with the sad culture they lived in, and I won't go into all that. So Huang Lung wakes up on his wedding day, and guess what? He's actually excited. And his dad was sort of old, decrepit, and he thought he needed his hand held to get out of bed and everything. And so Huang Lung wakes up a little bit early, and he's thinking, "This is the last day I got to stand up and make the fire. Somebody else is going to do it after this. Oh, this is wonderful." And he's there daydreaming, basically, and he's thinking how this house is just going to be full of children. Oh, it's going to be so great. And he had some interesting priorities, didn't he? There was something else. Oh, the other thing that amused me was he was very excited to think that after this, he would get his first bowl of rice while he was still in bed. And that was his goals, and he was all excited about this. Finally, his dad woke up and got to yelling at him to get the fire started. But even while he got his little fire burning there and made some hot water, here the water cooled off because he was thinking about how easy his life was going to be after he got married. And anyway, then wonder of wonders, he actually went and took a bath, and his dad thought he was crazy. I mean, he just had taken a bath on New Year's Day. What do you need another one for? And anyway, that was sort of some of the humor parts of it. So anyway, he goes to this great house, and he on the way, he buys this and that and gets trimmed up. And anyway, it's interesting for his strange culture. He still wanted to look his best. And so he goes up and picks up this girl, basically, and they head home, and that's that. And thinking about Huang Lung, I just thought it was interesting. You know, in some ways, his ideals, his goals, his things seem pretty far removed from me, don't they? Well, let's keep going. See, I would say that in that, Huang Lung was seeking meaning. And one of the things he was, especially even his dad brought this up different times, and it was the same for him, one thing that was extremely important was that there be boys. They basically called girl children slaves. But they had to have boys so that they could sort of live on their immortality almost. And this was a huge thing. Well, thankfully, his wife was fruitful in that way. She had two sons. But it was all a thing of finding meaning. And you know, his expectations, he didn't know her at all, but his expectations were exceeded. And I would say due to some good years for crops and to a thrifty and efficient wife, he was able to actually buy more land than what he had inherited, which was quite unusual for the time. Like I told you already, his wife bore him two sons, and the wonderful realization of his dreams. He also had two daughters then, which was rather bad luck. And about the time the second daughter showed up, the famine hit them, which I think they partially blamed it on the one daughter. And the area they lived in, it seemed like a famine came around every 4 to 7 years. It said if the gods were happy, maybe 7 years. If they were sour, it was 4 or 5. So excuse that, but yeah, I'm just saying how I said it. And this drought was more severe than most. The people around him, almost starved to death. The neighbors had it since he had bought this additional land. They thought he was rich, and so they came and stole what little he had. And finally, it got so desperate that they sold their furniture, everything, to some people who had come to buy their farm, and he couldn't sell his land, he didn't think, so he went to the city. And for a while, he just barely scraped by in the city, and he so longed to go back to his farm, to just get back to his farm, and to somehow make this work. So one day there was a bit of a riot involving a war, and he and his wife, separately but coincidentally, of course it's a story, both stumbled across quite a bit of money, he money and his wife jewels, which enabled them to go back to their farm. And as soon as they had the resources, they immediately returned to the land. He bought his ox and another ox, and he started farming again. And he determined in his mind he was never going to leave his land again. So enabled by the money and the jewels they had found, he bought more land, built a bigger house, better house, stored up more things. And he was going to be sure that the next time this famine came around, he was set up for it. He would be able to weather it. Seeking security, right? Seeking security. Anyway, after they were back, his wife bore twins, a boy and a girl. And you know, with three sons, his future seemed secure. In that way as well. And he did very well for 7 years. They had bountiful crops. He was able to store up, buy more land, do even better, hire more help. Finally, a famine did come after the 7 years. The famine came in the shape of a flood. It just flooded him out completely. But you know, he had enough to survive. And so, because his land was flooded, he became, I shouldn't say lazy, he was still a hard worker if he had the opportunity, but there really wasn't much to do. They did all the work, he had all this hired help, he paid his help a year in advance, so he had to find something for him to do, so it was silly for him to do that. So he started sitting in the tea house in town, then he started looking at the pictures they had on the wall, and anyway, one thing went to another. After a while, he goes home, and here his wife that has served him so faithfully starts picking fault with her feet, for one thing. Have you ever heard of China binding girls' feet? So his wife had not had hers bound, so he started thinking she looked so big and clumsy. And anyway, long story short, he ended up with a prostitute in this one tea house because, well, he had the resources, didn't have anything else to do, and unfortunately he didn't have Christ in his life either. And this began a fire that he just couldn't get enough of, and he was spending money and doing it and just couldn't get enough of this. And finally, he got the bright idea that he would buy her, this other woman, and bring her in his house as his second wife. So he did that, and he, after the day that she came to his house, he had built a new room for her, and he was there, and he thought, what could possibly go wrong? I've got it all together now. Well, I figured out pretty quick, and this is where he maybe seems silly to us, but anyway, hang in there. It didn't take long at all to him to realize that he had some bigger problems than he'd ever had before. These ladies didn't get along. First of all, the second wife came with some for uppity slave woman or servant that she thought she needed, and his first wife wouldn't even talk to the second wife, but she would basically take everything out she could on this other servant lady, and anyway, it caused major wars in his house. And so his pleasure led to a lack of peace. You know, after he had security, he turned to pleasure. After he had what he thought was pleasure, he found that it had taken his peace. So here we have a man now whose future, his meaning of life, in his limited terms, seemed secure. He had found meaning. He had sons. He had property. He had things he could pass on to the next generation, which was his goal. He had continued to prosper financially. Now, no 2 or 3 years of drought or flood could destabilize him. He was secure in his wealth and his position. He was admired. He was esteemed by his neighbors. He was the envy of the neighboring farmers with two wives in that culture, as they said, and an efficient and frugal housekeeper for one and a beauty for pleasure, and they thought he had it made. What more could he want? But he found out the things that he had now most desired seemed to be the very things that now took his peace. I'll come back to that in a while. We'll come back to Huang Lung, but let's keep going. I'd like for you to think about this. The things we sacrifice to get what we want become the very things we will desire when they are no longer possible. You agree with that? Have you ever done it? The things that you sacrifice to get what you want become the very things you will desire when they are no longer possible. So maybe one area that's really hit me a lot in the last number of years is seeing some of these, I'm going to call them poor, older, westernized Americans, you know, that have spent all their life chasing the American dream, having a couple cars, having the nice boat, having whatever, a big house. And yet now they're old and they sit here and their children are busy pursuing the American dream and they wish they would have a relationship with their child. That's one way of putting it. So they sacrificed what they had in an effort to get what they did not have, with the result that they now want what they sacrificed to get. And the thing that they thought would give them satisfaction is pretty empty. How often, even sadly, have I watched others madly casting aside the most valuable things in life in pursuit of what I will call tinsel. But then if I'm honest and stop myself, I realize that I have done the same myself. And I don't say this at anyone. It can be, if it's at anyone, let it be at me. But how short our memories seem to be. You know, it's not too uncommon to hear a married person rhapsodizing about the freedom of singlehood. I've heard it quite a bit. Yet some of those people, I knew them when they were single, and they thought it was a trial. How often have you heard the overwhelmed parent longing to serve? How often have you heard an overwhelmed parent thinking of all the things they could do if only their children didn't tie them down so much? Yet, before they were a parent, they felt deprived because God didn't give them that role. How short our memories seem to be. And I'm not saying this because I heard this at all this round, but I've done it myself, so I'm going to go ahead and say it. Since we just had reorganization, how strange is it that in one reorganization I feel neglected and forgotten because all these jobs and they didn't give me one? Maybe they don't think I know how to do anything. That sounds also carnal and sad, doesn't it? But it can hit you. And then the next time you're grumbling because, well, didn't they think there was anybody else here? I surely didn't have to do two things. How short our memories are. So I would like to consider these four things that Huang Lung sought, and I think we all seek, and how this process works. So looking at those things, meaning, security, pleasure, and peace. I think they're all things that we seek, can I say, at certain times in life. I'm not saying we all follow the pattern of Huang Lung. They may be arranged, maybe they have different times or order of importance for different of us. Yet I believe we all go through a time of seeking these things in some way. So I like to think of the foolish way to seek these things, or the wise way to seek these things. Meaning. So when I talk of meaning of or to life, you know, there's myriad ways that we go about seeking meaning. Our culture has a tendency to tell us what it thinks is important, and often we absorb some of those. Our friends share their views, and if you have a very good friend, it's sort of hard not to like to live up to what they think is important. Our parents show and tell us what's important to them. You know, and often these take various forms, but if we would boil them down, I would say a lot of times they take the form of, for example, popularity, being well thought of by others, liked, appreciated, esteemed. Who doesn't like to be popular? There may be some people that don't make it a goal to be popular necessarily, but if it comes their way, they're pretty happy with it, aren't they? And again, our culture, our friends, parents, has a large rule how that works. Another one is possessions. And possessions, I'm thinking of the collection of money or things that money can buy. You know, who of us to some degree doesn't rate others by their possessions? It's hard not to. It's hard not to. In fact, it's so hard not to. You know, business advice I was given one time, and I think it's actually true, they said if you want to sell a good job, drive a nice truck. Because why? Because we judge people by their performance somewhat, don't we? And if you want somebody to do a good job for you, if they show up, it looks like at least a few other people supported their good work at some point in the past, right? It's a subtle thing, but yet there's some truth to it. And the other one, I don't know, maybe this is a weak one in the Western world at least, but not so much in the Eastern cultures, but posterity. I just call that fruit of my body. You know, having children, another way that we can find meaning in life, or at least many do. What does God say about these things? Does God tell us, does God say that's where meaning is to be found? Why don't you just listen closely? I've got a lot of hopping around here. Let me just read 1 John 5, verse 12. 1 John 5, 12. God says this, he that hath the Son hath life. He that hath not the Son of God hath not life. You know, that doesn't mean that a non-Christian isn't alive. It just means that he doesn't have a lasting life. He doesn't have a meaningful life. He that hath the Son of God, well, added the Son of God there, hath life. It's just that simple. He that hath not the Son of God hath not life, doesn't have meaning in his life. Maybe to reinforce that one just a little bit, I'll read just a couple of verses scattered through John 3, verse 15. Christ speaking. So these are Christ's actual words, translated, that whosoever believeth in him, that's himself, should not perish, but have eternal life. If you believe in God, you've got something. If you don't, you don't. And John 3:16, the end of the verse, very same thing. He that believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. John 3, verse 36 then. He that believeth on the Son hath everlasting life, and he that believeth not the Son shall not see life, but the wrath of God abideth on him. So God's telling us that for true, lasting, worthwhile meaning, forget possessions, forget popularity, and even forget whether you have children or not. It's all in me in you. That's the only thing of value. And if we want to take that further, you take one of my favorite verses for myself, is Micah 6, verse 8. He has showed thee, O man, what is good, and what doth the Lord require of thee, but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God. Friends, there is nothing more to life that gives meaning to life than to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. And then I had down, actually, what I chose as memory verse. I frantically remembered it was my time to pick up a memory verse, so it's the next one, so I'll just give it to you. Proverbs 21:21, because I was just struck by this verse again. He that followeth after righteousness and mercy findeth life, righteousness and honor. And to me, that's just fascinating wording. He that followeth after, So the person that dedicates his life to seeking this after righteousness and mercy findeth what? He findeth meaning to life, righteousness, and honor. The very things people seek but are not finding, they find when they give up and seek God. Seek righteousness and mercy. We could go on to where Christ, I didn't put those verses down, but you know where he says that the children that have, the women that have bore children are going to be the same as the women that have not borne children. Finally, children, as precious and as wonderful as they are, really don't give meaning to life if I haven't found it otherwise. In fact, I create more meaning seekers. When we fail to follow righteousness and mercy, whatever fleeting meaning and fulfillment is found will be lost forever. Let's move on to the next one, security. I'm going to call this security in and of life. Here again, many people look in many places. And there's probably all of us would struggle a little bit in not thinking that a billionaire is fairly secure, wouldn't you? If I'd have $1 billion to just dispose of, I'd feel pretty secure compared to what I do. I mean, what health catastrophe could I have? What house could burn down that I couldn't build again? You know, what could happen to me? And that's one. I just made a list here in where people find security. First one I have down is influence. The ability to sway the thoughts and opinions of others. The second one I have is investments. Laying up in store for future rewards. And these couple of are related. The next one I have is savings, laying aside the surplus to provide for future needs. Fourth is business, the practice of diligence in the field of knowledge that I have in order to achieve gain. And then another one that some people, Huang Lung especially, found security in was his land. Something tangible and useful that I can see, that I can use, that I can say, hey, I have this to go back to. So what does God say about finding security in these things? Just listen again, maybe. Be just as wise. A bit of scattering around. Psalm 33:16-19. There is no king saved by a multitude of an host. A mighty man is not delivered by much strength. It says, an horse. Or maybe I could put in F-22 fighter jet or an M1 Abrams tank is a vain thing for safety. It's a vain thing for safety. Neither shall he deliver any by his great strength. Behold, the eyes of the Lord is upon them that fear him and upon them that hope in his mercy to deliver their soul from death and to keep them alive in famine. You know, to the natural man, if you'd have a just a man that says he's a Christian and wholeheartedly serving God, and you put that fighter jet or that tank out there with the afterburners on the on that plane, and you would say that plane's going to go kill that Christian. You know, God may allow it, but the reality is that fighter plane has very minute power compared to the Christian in living in God's will. And you know, for a natural man, that seems pretty silly, doesn't it? Think of a Christian knocking out a fighter plane. Not really. That's not necessarily how God's strength works. At the same time, think of the comparison. Let me again read. It says, in all this thing that he says is vain, then he says, behold, the eye of the Lord is upon them that fear him and upon them that hope in his mercy to deliver their soul from death and to keep them alive in famine. Maybe right here is a good way to point out that in some ways I'm talking of a paradox. You know, anybody in their right mind, if you were to say, here's a fighter plane loaded up, ready for battle, and here's a Christian and his prayers and his Bible, which one could keep you safe? Any natural man would say you were crazy to choose the man in the Bible, right? But yet there's the paradox, is God says the opposite of what man does. So am I foolish or wise? And who determines my foolishness or my wisdom? Psalm 147, verse 10 and 11 repeats it. He delighteth not in the strength of the horse. He taketh not pleasure in the legs of a man. The Lord taketh pleasure in them that fear him and in those that hope in his mercy. James chapter 5, verse 1 through 3 talks about wealth. Go to now, ye rich men. Weep and howl for your miseries that shall come upon you. Your riches are corrupted, your garments are moth-eaten, your gold and silver is cankered, and the rust of them shall be a witness against you, and shall eat your flesh as it were fire. Ye have heaped together treasures for the last days. You know, there's some people that far exceed billion, and I'm happy to exceed the title just billionaire, and I'm happy to let them with God, but you know, outside of God, they aren't worth a penny. They're not worth a penny. Luke 6, verse 21, 24, 25, the first part of the verse. Blessed are ye that hunger now. This is Christ's view of this whole thing. Blessed are ye that hunger now, for ye shall be filled. Blessed are ye that weep now, for ye shall laugh. But woe unto you that are rich, for ye have received your consolation. You have already had it. Don't be looking for anything more. Woe unto you that are full, for ye shall hunger. Luke 12, verse 21. So is he, like a fool, so is he that layeth up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. Okay, I'm going to go on and get fairly blunt here, and so bear with me. And like I said, that's the sad part, is how am I supposed to do this and get done in any sort of time? Yeah, still have you love me, maybe, I don't know, but I'll let that. Have you ever noticed how in the things of life, I see this by looking into my own heart. If I'm insecure in where I stand on an issue, I often touch you about that subject. Have you ever noticed that? So I'm going to deem that you all are secure on the subject I want to touch on next, because I don't mean to hurt anybody. I think it may be a pet for one or two of you. So just correct anything I say wrong, because I likely will say something wrong on this. So like I said, since I hope y'all are secure in this, I'm going to speak plainly, but I'd just like to read 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 18 in relation to this. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 18 through 21, the first part of the verse. Let no man deceive himself. If any man among you seemeth to be wise in this world, let him become a fool, that he may be wise. For the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God, for it is written, he taketh the wise in their own craftiness. And again, the Lord knoweth the thoughts of the wise. They are vain. Therefore, let no man glory in men. Okay, so to the blunt part. It seems to me that we would all say we agree with this verse, and probably for the most part live like we do, until we get to business and finances. And then I feel, myself included, buy fairly heavily into the world's philosophy and view. When you're trying to decide how to invest, how to best do your money, do you turn to another church brother who has proven himself faithful, even though maybe he doesn't have that much with what God has given? Or do you go listen to the philosophers of the world that can tell you all the greatest, latest and the greatest ways to use this money? Again, intent is not here at all to stand in judgment of certain men. Yet at the same time, I do feel that if we don't challenge each other, it makes me think of the one newspaper. Their slogan is, democracy dies in darkness. And the thought is that if they don't speak up about what they see, these things will happen. And I guess that's how I'm saying. I'm not accusing, I'm not saying this has happened, but if we don't honestly speak of them, will they happen? That's a little bit like me yesterday, come to think of it. Marcus was very kindly helping me put up a little carport, and we were about done, and I had my ladder on this sloping bank here, and I do a lot of ladder work. I know all about ladders, and I thought I do. So I'm standing there, and we're putting these screws in. All of a sudden, the ladder ran away from underneath me, and I don't know what Marcus thought. He looked awful surprised when he saw me disappear and then scrambling back up. Glad I wasn't hurt worse than I was. But in thinking about that, you know, sometimes maybe our very confidence becomes our downfall. We do this. We know how this works. We understand. So let's think about this, if nothing else. And like I said, not to be accusing at all, and not to be anti-people, even though I will mention one person specifically, just so to give you food for thought. It seems to me there seems to be a human inclination to find it difficult to separate between a wise man and his wisdom without also accepting his foolishness. Have you ever seen that? So if you see somebody really wise in one area, and they have a lot of good, this individual I mentioned actually has some very common sense things. I think they're great in that sense. And so I'm not telling you to get rid of his books. I'm not telling you to stop listening to him. I'm just saying, can we insert a bit of a doubt about some of his stuff? And that's these popular financial gurus of today. And then one I'm going to mention is Dave Ramsey. He's one of the chiefs he seems to be currently. And while I think he's very wise and a lot smarter than me and can tell you all about compound interest and everything, I think there's a bit of a temptation to swallow some of his stuff that to me is a burden on my heart. And I'll just share it and you do with it whatever you want to. The first one that I've struggled with him a bit is the saving for retirement. I want to be clear, I'm not against saving. But let's also be clear that saving for heaven is far more important than how much I have for retirement. And I personally think that, without judging the man, that when I at least listen to him, I feel he overemphasizes it to where this is more important. And I have some friends that have bought wholeheartedly into his doctrine. And you know what one of them told me? He said, I'll have time to help others once I reach my financial goals. Friends, he won't. He won't have time. And that's not, I'm not blaming Dave Ramsey for that. He made his choices. At the same time, I do think maybe there's a subtle influence there. Think about it. I'll let it with you. You know, as a Christian, I may be called to live a life, a lifestyle, to live a job style that to somebody like him may look very unwise. But in reality, where is the eternal investment? The second one I would just caution, or at least ask you to think about, is investment. You know, I had an investor in Jonesboro, a man I think highly of still. And I think I would trust him absolutely so far as honesty. And he basically offered that if I'd write him a check for $10,000, I'm a little foggy on the details. I think he wanted 30 years and he would have at least $100,000 for me. Pretty good return, isn't it? And I discussed it a while with him. And so he was telling me his program, how he does this and how he invests here and invests there. And which companies and stuff to some degree. I was surprised he told me as much as he did, really. But, you know, I think, as far as I know, he's a professing Christian. And he would be pretty careful what he invests in. But at the end of the day, without judging him, he's not investing in things that I could put my money towards. Like government bonds, for instance. You know, when you're in this investing game business, I feel inevitably your focus shifts to where the best returns are, and you begin to become tempted to invest things that you probably wouldn't have at the start, especially if there's high returns. And then you begin getting entangled in businesses that are definitely not necessarily building the kingdom of heaven in various ways. Then also the business ethics begin to come in. What about this company that has Chinese slaves currently assembling phones and so on and so on? And it's difficult, and I don't know that I can draw a line. I'm not attempting to. But at the same time, to me it's a little different buying a product for my use other than giving them my money to use to further their agenda. And then the third one is insurance. And that's the last one. Just to be clear, I do not feel that I'm anti-insurance and that I am not against making sure that my mistakes and any damage that I cause can be corrected as much as possible, at least. Neither am I against banding together with others to help the needs of others. I want that clear. Yet I do have a real hesitancy to try to make, when I see an attitude or an effort to make things so sure that nothing can be touched. Nothing that I have can be touched without me accepting a loss and deciding maybe God didn't want me to have that. Friends, how loud do we want God to need to shout to get our attention? I personally, while I'm okay with carrying insurance to make up for my failures and things, and while I'm happy to share in your sharing plans, I personally have a number of things I purposefully have not put under the sharing plan simply because I want to trust God with at least a little bit. I'm not sure where to draw that line, and may God bless you as you decide that for yourself. I'm not here to do it for you. I have to admit, I very much question and have real hesitancy in having everything sewn up so tight as to where I feel that I would be fully wise in the eyes of man. And you know, I'm especially troubled when this begins or enters into the process of trying to ensure that my family or I will have no needs that will need supplied and filled by others, and referring especially maybe to life insurance. And there's a push, friends, there's a push in our type of churches to allow for life insurance. And I, again, don't want to accuse a person falsely, but I think that comes from some of these financial people and their teaching partly. I personally want to be part of a brotherhood that if I fall down preaching this message, I can have full confidence that my brotherhood is going to step in and take care of the needs of my wife and family. And I want you to have the full confidence that I'll do the best I can. And to me, that far exceeds any policy or plan. And the more we become enmeshed in things, the more we will lose some of these value aspects, is what I firmly believe. Okay, enough beating around. 1 Timothy 5, verse 5 and 7 talks about a widow, but I'd like to broaden this. It says, "Now she that is a widow indeed and desolate trusteth in God and continueth in supplications and prayers night and day." And then Paul goes on in verse 7, it tells Timothy, "And these things give in charge that they may be blameless." Dear friends, to me it's much more important than what size of business any of us has or what our income is. Do we see ourselves as a widow, if you want to use that word indeed, and desolate, trusting in God and continuing in supplications and prayer night and day? Our whole culture, our whole financial system is to take us away from that dependency on God. And I'm not saying you have to fight that battle exactly as I do, but I am saying you need to fight it somehow, or you will end up in a place you do not intend to be. Flat on the ground with your head knocking the rocks, and it's not going to feel good. Okay, moving on to the last one. I'll keep this one brief. Pleasure is pleasure in life. You know, in some, and I want to say this carefully, I think pleasure seeking, in at least some of our circles, is almost an unmentionable subject, and especially in very conservative circles, it's almost like God doesn't want us to have a good time or something. And I think we need to be careful. God did not put us on earth just to have a blast, if you want to say it that way, right? He had a bigger purpose than just a party. At the same time, I would like to suggest to you that God is not anti-pleasure, but he is anti-selfishness. God has built in some very wonderful pleasures, and I don't necessarily think I'm going to stand up here and enumerate. Some of you probably know quite well what some of them are. Maybe it's just the pleasure of sitting outside watching a sunrise or a sunset. To me, that's one of the beautiful things that I like and a hobby I have. It's just the pleasure, and I don't think that's a wrong pleasure. But now if my turn to preach comes up and I'm unwilling to sacrifice that pleasure because then maybe I've got a problem. So God is not anti-pleasure, but he's anti-selfishness. Because you cannot be selfish while you're living for God. It doesn't fit. Proverbs 21:17 says, "He that loveth pleasure shall be a poor man. He that loveth wine and oil shall not be rich." May I change that verse a little bit? I don't mean to twist it. But remember, under the old covenant, if you lived wholly for God, it was very often, if not always anyway, he blessed physically, right? Think of Job and all those others. So in the Old Testament, overall, the Old Covenant, it seems like God blessed with physical things when there was spiritual obedience. Under the New Covenant, he doesn't promise that I'm going to have a lot of horses, cows, or any size business. But what he does promise is that I will be rich spiritually. So let's read that verse again in thinking about spiritual. "He that loveth pleasure shall be a poor man spiritually." That's right. That's still true, isn't it? It's not saying pleasure is bad, but if I love it, if it becomes what I live for, what I'm willing to sacrifice my principles for, it becomes my downfall. Ecclesiastes 2 verse 1, "Who but Solomon gave pleasure all he had?" There was nobody probably ever since that could do everything he did. Just he had the position, he had everything where he could just do this thing whole hog. And so in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 1, the first part of the verse, he says, "I said in mine heart, go now, I will prove thee with mirth. And then, therefore enjoy pleasure, And then I just made my own list of words that he had in the next number of verses. Hilarity, a good time, a party. He built buildings, he bought farms, he made lakes, he planted forests, he bought slaves, he hoarded treasures. He got the best musicians and had the best music. He indulged in all the senses and desires that a man has. Yet in verse 11 he says, "Then I looked on all the works that of my hands had wrought, and on the labor that I had labored to do, and all the pleasures I had tried to experience. And behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun." That's the end of a pleasure seeker. Let's go back to Luke 6. I read you some verses there. The last part of verse 25, you know, in verse, I think it was verse 21, he says, basically he blesses the people that are crying now. Then in verse 25, he says, "Woe unto you that laugh now, for you shall mourn and weep." Going back to the widow part, 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 6 says, "But she that liveth in pleasure is dead while she liveth." As you look up that word pleasure there, it means she that lives to please herself. She that lives to please herself is dead while she lives. And it goes on and gives the thought of overindulgence, taking more than what I need. Some relaxation is good, but if that becomes my focus, it's now a pleasure that becomes dangerous spiritually. It also means to become soft. And you know, I've seen this so many times. It's a little bit like I love to treat my girls with Andy's ice cream, for example. But you know what happens if we do it once or twice when we're in town? The next time we didn't go to Andy's. And you know, it shifts so quickly from a legitimate and somewhat low-key indulgence for one time or twice to now it's a right. And it's not, friends. A Christian doesn't have a right to any kind of pleasure. James 5:5 again. "Ye have lived in pleasure on the earth and have been wanton. Ye have nourished your hearts as in a day of slaughter." You know, rather than it being an occasional time of relaxation, a time to rejuvenate myself physically, emotionally, it becomes a way of life, a right. And he says those people are on the wrong place. Okay, moving on to the peace in or of life. You know, 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 3 says this, "For when they shall say peace and safety, then sudden destruction cometh upon them as travail upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape." What's interesting is that slogan, peace and safety, was the slogan of the Roman Empire. Peace, safety. If you saw their trucks down the road, they said, "Roman Empire, peace and safety." That's what they sold. Yet they didn't. You know, peace is one of those things that when it's achievable, it's not valued. That's what I've, not at least for myself. And when it's valued, it seems like sometimes we move beyond the place where it's achievable. Now, I know there's always repentance. Let's go back to Huang Lung. So this man had three sons. These sons grew up. They became educated. They were, and he was so proud of them. And he got them married off and had grandchildren. Oh, he had it made. But then you know what? The one son, the oldest son, worried about what people thought and was always wanting to spend his money. And the second son was a hoarder and he didn't want to spend a dime. And these sons got so mad at each other they couldn't even talk. And here you had this poor old man that all he wanted was peace. And yet there was no peace. His first wife died, so he thought, oh, now he have peace. All he has is the pretty one left. And then she wanted to send a slave girl to do something that Huang Lung was sort of kind-hearted fellow, and he didn't make her do it. And so he lost her, too. She was too mad to see him anymore. And this was just an old man that wanted to relax and enjoy life and all he had worked for, peace. But it wasn't there. You know, I had to think of Isaiah 53, verse 5. Talking of Christ, he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. Then I love this phrase, just jumped out at me this morning. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed. May I put that into my words, that phrase, the chastisement of our peace was upon him? If I put that in my own words, I would say that he, Christ, paid the cost and or the pain of my possibility for peace. Christ paid the price and the pain for me to have peace. Ephesians 2:14, it talks, and it's talking about the conflict between the Jew and the Gentile. And Paul just says, for he, Christ, is our peace. You know what takes conflict away from our lives is being one in Christ. Well, maybe I should say that different. Is being one with Christ, first of all. And then also, if you have conflict in your relationships, being one in Christ. The chastisement of my peace was upon him. He paid that price. You know, poor Huang Long, so successful, so wise, and yet so foolish. Outside of Christ, outside of the cross, there's just no peace. And you know, that seems crazy to a carnal-minded person, and it seems crazy to me some days too in thinking that peace comes through a cross. Can you think of anything less peaceful than a cross? Incidentally, according to this story, about the only exposure that Huang Lung had to Christ was a white man handed him a picture of Christ on the cross, and he took it home, and it sort of scared him. He couldn't figure out why anybody would be so mean to somebody else. Then he and his dad decided that the fellow on the cross must be some awful person to be treated that way. And you know, that's not true. He was the way of peace for Huang Lung, and he's the way of peace for me. And he paid that price. Peace is not so much the absence of conflict, but it is wholly trusting and giving myself to God in the midst of conflict. And would you please seriously consider this, no matter what you think about some of the other things I said, the things wherein I imagine lies my happiness become the means of my loss of happiness. So often the very things that I would think, if I could only have this, I would be happy, I'd be fulfilled, I'd have it made, is oftentimes, dear friends, the very thing that will take away any possibility of happiness in my life. Many times the things we so desperately want in life become the very things that take the ability, our ability to have peace. When making decisions, when choosing for my life, will what I gain permanently outweigh what I lose by the choice? How much have I bought into the wisdom of this world? How much do I subscribe to the philosophy of this time and this place? Or am I a philosopher of heaven? When I seek outside of God, I will always lose more than what I gain. When I seek to gain something outside of God, I will always lose more than I gain. May God help us, each one, in fighting that battle and however it faces you. Could we please kneel for prayer?